Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Please consider supporting Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
This is Dmitry Samarov from Chicago, Illinois. And I love listening to Vish Khanna's Creative Control because whether he's talking to a favorite musician or actor of mine or someone I've never heard of, it's as if he's introducing me to a new friend. And the way things are going, couldn't you use a new friend? Listen now.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Rob Mazurek is a tremendously gifted multi-instrumentalist, abstractionist, visual artist, sculptor, and sound explorer who originally hails from Chicago, Illinois. Currently based in Marfa, Texas, Mazurek assembled a particularly expansive version of his Exploding Star Orchestra to create one of the finest and most vivid albums of 2020. It's called Dimensional Stardust and was co-released by International Anthem and None Such Records on November 20th. And so Rob returned to this show to speak with me about moving to Texas, outer space and science fiction and futurism, why he starts each and every day by creating a morning drone, the cast and crew that made Dimensional Stardust, future plans, and more. A part of the Entertainment One Network, with the support of listeners like you, who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it, and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol. and Massey Hall's concert film series live at MasseyHall.com, where you can stream dozens of 30-minute films for free, including performances by past podcast guests like Zaki Ibrahim, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. This is the 585th episode of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented Rob Mazurek, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Rob. How's it going?
Hey, man. Nice to hear your voice again.
It is nice to hear your voice again, too. It's been so long that I can't remember the last time we spoke, but it's always a pleasure. This is like the fourth time I think you've been on this particular show. Can you believe that?
That's incredible. It's an honor.
some changes afoot, though. I think in the past we've met in Guelph, Ontario, and I now live in Edmonton, Alberta. Have you ever been to Edmonton, Alberta?
Oh, that's right. You moved. No, I haven't. I hear there's a festival there, though, but I don't think I've ever... No, I've never been there. How is it? Beautiful?
Well, it's fine. We are currently in the midst of a provincial emergency, like a health emergency because of the pandemic. Our government did not handle it well. The closest thing to America, Rob, in Canada might well be Alberta. So that's...
Oh, my goodness. That's
a bit...
Well, that equals disaster. So hopefully, you know what I mean?
It's not the best. Sorry, I'm being selfish here. Where in the world are you today, Rob?
Well, I'm in Marfa, Texas. So we moved out here about 5 years ago. I'm a Texan for five years at this point.
Wow. So what prompted you say you moved there 5 years ago. Did you move from Chicago, or where did you move from?
Yeah, it was from Chicago. I lived in Brazil for a while, as you mm-hmm. know. But then yes. I moved back to Chicago in 2008 and lived there till about 2014. And then my wife and I were looking to buy a house in a more quiet, calm environment, and I took her out here to Marfa, Texas. I had played a show in Marfa over 10 years ago, around 12 years ago, with Chicago Underground Duo, and just fell in love with this small town. It's a 2,000 person small town in far west Texas, and it's an amazing place. I mean, it houses the permanent work of one of my favorite artists, which is Donald Judd.
Oh.
And so his whole aesthetic here and what he's built of the place, plus the built-in cultural stuff that happens here. There's also the Lannan Foundation, which is a literary foundation, which is very powerful. It brings in writers from all over the world to do residencies here. Chinati Foundation, Judd Foundation, dealing with the works of Donald Judd and like his kind of stable of artists that he liked. So there's always artist talks, people coming in from New York, LA, London, wherever, literature, poetry. You know, I started Desert Encrypts here a couple years ago, so bringing some musicians out and trying to make some interesting music. It's a very interesting small town in far west Texas that is in the middle of the desert and about an hour away from the Mexican border.
Okay, so is it where is it in relation to, say, like, Dallas, Houston, places we might have heard of?
I mean, it's very far. Texas is such a large state. I mean, it's 7-8 hours from Austin, from Dallas, from San Antonio. El Paso's closer. El Paso is 3 hours away.
Yeah.
And when I fly to Europe and when I tour or fly out of here, we fly out of El Paso. And that's about a 3-hour drive.
Yeah, because I ask it because I think some of us who haven't been might be surprised to hear of the rich artistic history in Texas to some degree. I mean, I was in Denton, Texas once on a tour, and someone was like, yeah, Dave Brubeck spends a lot of time here or spent a lot of time here, and there's a whole program at the school here devoted to him. I was like, what? Really, in Texas? And then you're talking about Donald Judd, who was a physical artist, right? That's who he was.
Yeah, artist, writer, everything.
Yeah. So, is there something about that stuff, the history there, that might have drew you to Marfa, Texas? Because I'm just curious. Like, I know you like to go where the action is, Rob.
I think I've had enough of that in the life, so I always had this kind of fantasy of living in the desert, you know. So, this place just seemed perfect. Like I said, I came here with Chad Taylor with Chicago Underground Duo years ago, and we visited all of the foundations. And I'm a visual artist as well, as you know. So, I had been reading Donald Judd's writings for years, and actually seeing his permanent installations here was just incredible. So I like to go places where I can draw off of certain energies, you know, and certainly the energy of his work, the energy. This is also designated black sky area right here, designated dark sky. So it's your relationship to the cosmos is pretty intimate. You can see the Milky Way every night, and it's wonderful.
What is that? I'm not familiar with that designation. What is it? What does that designation exactly mean? I think you kind of explained it. What does that mean?
There aren't a lot of lights here.
Just as simple as that. Okay.
which is getting a little worse because, you know, there's been fracking and things like that that are encroaching on the area slowly, which is creating some light. But the McDonald Observatory is here, is 30 minutes away, which you might have heard on National Public Radio. You know, they have a show that's based from the McDonald Observatory.
Oh, okay.
Which you can go to, and they have star parties, so you can look through these high-powered telescopes. Of course, I visited there because of my interest in the cosmos and space and science fiction and all, and fantastic to look into how they actually use the high-powered telescopes and also the collection of radio waves and sound waves from outer space.
Yeah, I know you're interested in the cosmos. I know you're interested in outer space. I have a sense that those interests have influenced your beautiful new album, Dimensional Stardust. Before we get to that, I'm just curious, do you have a sense of where your interest in otherworldly activity, outer space, peering into the darkness above us, where does that interest sort of stem from?
I started reading the books of Stanislaw Lem, you know, the great Polish science fiction writer, best known for, you know, writing the book Solaris,
right?
Which of course turned into the Tarkovsky movie and then the more modern version. But I've been reading all his books for years, and that kind of started my fascination on the whole thing. Also, I heard Sun Ra live when I was 16 years old at the Chicago Jazz Festival, and reading up on him and buying, you know, the great biography on him that was, what's the author? Is it John Zwed? But Space is the Place.
Yeah, that sounds familiar. Yeah, right.
And reading his writings about the cosmos and also Egyptology and all kinds of ideas, you know, starting to read, you know, back years ago, the science fiction of Samuel R. Delaney, you know, Dahlgren, Nova, Stars in My Pocket, like Grains of Sand, you know, yeah. all these great, and my overall curiosity and interest in future, in futurology, you know. I'm not a very nostalgic person, you know. I'm trying to think of now and the future and what could be.
Yeah.
And since science fiction deals with, you know, what could be, I'm very much thinking of these futurological situations that we might find ourselves in.
Do you, and I don't mean this in any pejorative way, but there seems to me to be a little bit of restlessness within you in that regard. I mention it because we talked about places you've lived, Chicago, Brazil. Now you're in Texas, among the other places you've lived. And I feel like in your exploration of science fiction, there is a little bit of escaping from temporal restrictions, you know, like the now, like you're thinking about the future.
Right.
Is that, again, this is not meant to be a psychiatric session, but does this speak to something within you? Like you're just constantly interested in moving forward. What does that say about, does that say something about you as a musician as well?
I mean, I think so. I think I was talking to somebody the other day, they asked me a sort of similar question, you know, what keeps me interested and going, and it's just there's so much to discover, you know. But I always feel like I'm making things in the moment. So of course I'm in the moment as well, because I make things all day. I wake up in the morning. The first thing I do is I come to my modular synthesizers and I make what I call a morning drone. You know,
to set
the tone of the house, you know, to get good energy in the house. And it's an exercise, but it's also a way for me to compose first thing in the morning, every morning, using somewhat non-traditional means. You know, I used to come and sit down at the piano, but now I go to the modular and I make these drones. And then after I make the first drone, I go outside to the painting studio and I'll work on whatever paintings or sculptures I have at the moment. But I'm bringing what I made inside with the sound outside to what I'm doing visually. Then I bring out what I'm doing visually outside in the way of color, texture, form. I bring that back in and continue work on the drone, which will eventually become a composition. While that's going on, I have my piano here that I inherited from the great Bill Dixon, for instance. It's an object of great power to me, you know, and my trumpets and my cornets and organs and other synthesizers and percussion instruments and flutes and all kinds of things. At the same time, I have a drawing table in my sound studio, as well as I have speakers in my visual studio, which is unattached outside the house. So I know I'm kind of answering the question in a very long way, but I'm just interested in making. I'm interested in doing things now. And what keeps me doing this stuff is I keep having this sense that things are just outside of my reach, you know? Just that, like if I could just crack the wall open a little bit more. I'm trying to see and find out the simple question of why we're even here. You know what I mean?
It's like you're every day you're aspiring to something, but you don't know what it is you're aspiring to, maybe?
Well, I'm definitely trying to, with all this music and artists, I'm trying to project light and a kind of energy that I draw off of, but also other people can draw off of. So I'm trying to break through this kind of how mass media and mainstream media treats everything is so similar and so much the same. I'm trying to find something else, you know, and that's why the idea of space, the uncharted territories, the what we don't know, the hundreds of galaxies that turn in thousands of galaxies and millions of galaxies. I mean, it's endless.
Yeah.
And the thought that there's another ecosystem out there that's close enough to a sun in order to create some kind of life similar to ours, because of course there's life, that's different than ours, you know.
there has to be.
But we often talk in terms of life that is similar to ours. Why does it have to be similar to ours?
Right.
But there has to be, you know. And I guess these questions I'm constantly moving through my head as I'm trying to create these sound and visual energy fields in order to kind of crack through that somehow through sound and vision.
I wonder if living in different states, different countries, different continents is your version of exploring spaces that are similar but different to yours. Does that make sense? I feel like that's why some of us travel.
I mean, that's absolutely true. I mean most places, you know, while I'm touring, you don't really get to get super deep into, but certainly my when I do residencies, and certainly when I moved to Brazil in 2000, you know, I lived in the Amazon rainforest. Manaus, an amazing, you know, city in the middle of the rainforest, you know, and experienced all of the wonders of the rainforest, the Black River, the White River, the meetings of the river, what's in the river, the pink dolphins, the electric eels, you know, the howler monkeys from afar that sound like, you know, a Ligeti score. So it's like, and then from there, moving to like Brasilia, which is plateau and kind of like the desert, beautiful open skies, and you have the architecture of the famous Brazilian architect. It's not coming to me, but the way they designed that city, the way they designed you know, the satellite cities for Brazil, and you know, it's just so living there, drawing off of that energy, you know, and then also there I met the amazing composer Guilherme Vaz. I don't know if you've even heard of him, but Guilherme Vaz, V-A-Z, is an amazing composer from Brasilia who we had a kind of intimate relationship with, musically speaking, and you know, speaking of art and stuff, kind of like the Cecil Taylor of you know, the high plateau of Brasilia, you know, but amazing composer. And then, living in São Paulo is a whole nother ecosystem. You know, the energy of São Paulo is incredible, as well as spent a lot of time in Rio, the energy in Rio, you know.
Every region you're talking about has its own kind of figurehead, doesn't it? That's the other thing. You mentioned a couple of composers that I wasn't familiar with. I think you were alluding to possibly Oscar Niemeyer. Is that the architect you might have met?
Exactly.
Yes. And then
Oscar Niemeyer's architecture is like from outer space itself, you know?
Yeah, and Donald Judd. Like, it sounds like you're drawn to not only these places, but you want to get into not only their whatever sociocultural history, but who was here? Who helped set the tone a little bit?
Right.
Because I was thinking about your morning ritual, where you start out on the drone, and then that's kind of a tone-setting moment for each day. By the way, just as a friend, do you have breakfast? You mentioned that you do the drone, and then you go into the art studio, and I'm like, wait, Rob, when do you eat? Do you have breakfast between those things?
Well, after I make the drone, I skipped one important thing. Okay, I make the drone, which could take 5 minutes if I hit the right frequencies, or it could take an hour
you know,
before I set the tone, because I'm setting the tone for myself and my wife, Britt. So after I get that going, I go in the kitchen, which is next to the studio, and I make coffee. Mm-hmm. So I make the coffee with milk, which I have every morning.
Okay.
And I bring a cup to my wife, and I take my cup out to the studio. So I don't really have a breakfast per se. I might have a cup of coffee with cream and a biscuit or something like that, or a cookie or something, just to get it going.
Just some nourishment.
And then around midday, and then around midday, I like to do more of the kind of Italian style of eating, where you have a kind of nice home-cooked lunch, you know, larger lunch.
Yeah.
So in between there, I'll make the lunch becomes the first full meal because I love to cook as well.
Okay, so, I just wanted to establish that for health purposes. I wanted to make sure that was happening. But my other point,
yes, believe me, I love eating. Maybe a little bit too much.
My point here is when you told some very sort of inspiring stories about the drone, the tone setting aspect of the drone, and how that might carry you through the day, and you might revisit it. Does the drone ever throw off the day? Does the drone ever portend, why did that sound? This might not be the best day because of what the drone is telling me. Do you ever have that? Has that ever happened?
Oh, that's very interesting. But no, it doesn't. And the reason it doesn't happen, because I don't let myself leave the drone until it's set at the right frequencies to really resonate a positive full energy.
Okay.
So that's the starting point. So once that starting point happens, that's it. It's feeling good, you know.
Yeah.
Now the problem is later in the day, as I, you know, start to organize more and construct off of the drone, things can get a little hairy and sometimes go a little wrong. Then it can get a little, but because I've already set the tone, that's okay. Because then it part of my mantra is this life is an experiment. So whether it's making the drone, making a painting outside, cooking a mole, it's all an experiment to me.
Right,
you know.
Right.
So rather than when something goes wrong, looking at it as if it's some kind of disaster, I look at it as this is a beautiful disaster that I can then make something else out of.
Interesting. Okay, I appreciate the answer there, because I just imagine sometimes I at the end of the day, if it hasn't gone well, I think back on what happened and I blame a thing. I'm like, you know what? I think everything went wrong because of that English muffin. I didn't really like that. So I wonder if you have the same process. Like, wait a minute. This day was kind of weird. What was the drone like in the morning? Like, that's where I was coming from.
Oh my God! Now that's in my head, so I'm gonna you know keep a close ear on that.
So I alluded to the fact that you have this very highly acclaimed new record, Dimensional Stardust. First of all, congratulations! How are you feeling now that this album is circulating and people are receiving it? How are you feeling?
It feels really good because, I mean, my reason, like I said, for even making this stuff is kind of what people are saying now about this record. You know, people are talking about how it's making their day resonate bright, lifting up. Of course, it's good timing, you know, with the elections that happen here. And part of the reason for releasing the record when it was is to lift, you know. So, I'm pretty happy with what's been happening so far with the release of the record. I literally just got my vinyl in the mail like 2 days ago. So I was people were receiving their vinyls before I even got mine. But I got mine and I was like, oh my goodness, you know, as an object itself, it's so like it just feels really strong and powerful in my hands. And then spinning
I need to order one. I need to order one. I'm sorry, I haven't done that yet.
We'll send you one.
No,
but it
no,
feels
no.
really
you always,
good.
It's, Rob, you yeah. always give me records, and I appreciate it, but I feel like it's too much. I always feel like I was putting my record collection together here in Alberta, and I'm like, man, Rob has given me so many of his records. Like, it's so sweet and so nice, but no, thank you. I'm going to order it. I've been trying to support my fellow musicians by you know ordering things and it's beautiful. I also am looking forward to seeing it because the artwork is lovely. I want to start there actually. You are a visual artist. What can you say about the aura, I suppose, the cover of Dimensional Stardust? What is your perception or perspective on it?
Well, I mean I've had this way that I do things for really since the 5 years I've lived here. We bought the house here 5 years ago, like I said, and these morning drones and my mantra of doing the stuff on the modular, then going out to the studio to paint or sculpt, coming mm-hmm. back to work on music, going back out, coming back. I mean, I was making this painting as I was composing the music for this record, you know.
Oh, wow.
So I, same kind of thing, although most of this record I was composing on the piano here, because I do use the piano when I compose, and mm-hmm. some computer stuff, but I was doing it at the same time. So when the record was coming more and more into full fruition, so was the painting, you know. And this particular painting, by the end of each, by the end of composing the music and editing it, and just before editing it, but recording it, almost mixing it, the painting was done, you know. So this mm-hmm. painting, which is two-thirds of the painting, it's not the whole painting, but it's two-thirds of the painting, took almost the same amount of time to make that as it did the music. It was a kind of a 3-year period, you know. Now sometimes I'll make a painting in a day.
Yeah, know? Was so, it conscious on your part? Was that a conscious parallel trajectory between the music and the art? Like, you thought these two things are connected, so I'm going to work on them in parallel? Or was it just the way it worked out?
Halfway through, I noticed that it was totally in parallel. So I was thinking about it at the same time. I wasn't trying to finish the painting or the music at any particular same time or anything. Mm. I like to deal in layers a lot. So this particular painting has 25, 30 layers to it. You know, there were many renditions of the painting before it became what it is right now. Maybe that's part of the reason it has so much energy to it. But same thing with the music. You know, I composed this music, and then because of a commission from the Berlin Jazz Festival 3 years ago, and started composing it, then did the concert 2 years ago, you know, and then with musicians from Berlin and the U.S., mostly from Chicago, mm-hmm. and then restructured the music and recorded the music in Chicago after that, and then spent the better part of 6 months editing and you know, putting the pieces together for that, and then finally coming out with the final product, which was... is what the recording is right now. And also dealing in layers, also dealing in different interpretations of different things. The concert in Berlin was much more improvised. But the final product here, the final music is almost 90% composed, you know. So it's a very, very composed, layered, compositional recording. And I feel the exact same way with the painting. I mean, the painting turned out to be very dealing with some of the same issues of resonance and form and line and lyrical, and you know, you can feel gesture in both things, but you can also feel kind of harder, soft lines with all the repeating repetition and figures as well.
You know, sometimes when I speak to musicians or artists who work in the realms of improvisation and composition, I trip over myself a little bit just talking about sort of the kind of interrelated aspects to those two forms of expression, and maybe even the tension between them. Mm-hmm. So forgive me if this question seems weird, but in retrospect, do you view the Berlin improvised gathering as something of a framework or a practice? I know you probably didn't think of it at the time as a rehearsal or any sort of thing, but was the improvised thing that became the Chicago sessions and the more composed version, when you say it's composed, that composition is drawn from the improvisation, I assume, or am I actually going too far? What is the relationship between the composition that you're describing and the improvisation that occurred in Berlin?
Yeah, I mean the compositions were already composed before Berlin. For the Berlin performance, though, when we play live, there's a thing where anything could happen. I trust all the musicians implicitly, and the whole idea is live is that you have these constructs that we can play exactly how they are, and it is what it is. Or, you know, for the Berlin concert, I decided 1 second before we started that the first 15 minutes were going to be improvised. You know, I didn't decide the first 15 minutes were going to be improvised. I decided to start improvising first. You know, before it resulted in a
15-minute improvisation. And it ended up,
I think we played three of the compositions, and the rest was improvisations off of motifs and things off of the compositions. So it's not rehearsal. That's like its own separate entity. It's like its own ship, you know, that sails through the sky, you know, and I could have use that if I chose, but I really wanted to get really succinct because I felt really strongly about the written composition that would really have a different kind of and the energy that I was looking for this exact moment, and that's exactly what happened.
But I assume that if you've gathered musicians together and you've improvised for 15 minutes, there must be some sense or memory recall perhaps the next time you go to your modular synthesizer or what have you, like that absolutely. Does inform the next things you make, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been in improvising as well as composing musician for 30 years, so I get a lot of my ideas straight from improvisation, of course, you know,
right.
because I'm a, you know, I'm one of these people who I want to listen to what I've played and done and composed and improvised. You know, I'm interested in seeing the architecture of that, learning from that, and seeing how I can build from that. You know, so all of these compositions and all of the pretty severe interval jumps and things. I mean, that's from years and years of not only studying composition and improvisation, you know, and how to make an improvisation interesting or a composition interesting, you know, based on, like I said, interval, melody, harmony, noise, you know. I mean, there's high, low, middle. There's so many things to think about. But certainly from improvisations over the years and years and years, you build a certain vocabulary just from the practice of improvisation.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then to me, the best composers are people that can take the best parts of those things and really hone in and crystallize or abstract. You know, oftentimes I'll say, I'm an abstractivist. I'm actively seeking to abstract, meaning actively seeking to abstract something into its purest essence. You know?
Yeah.
So from these improvisations in the past, before I actually put these compositions to paper, for sure improvisation played a giant factor in note choice, rhythm choice, musicians used, and all of that. And what's also very interesting is even though the musicians are playing almost 90% written material, we're also talking about musicians who are super steeped and masters at improvisation.
Yeah.
So the most subtlest thing, you know, because they're not machines. Everyone has a different breathing, way of breathing, a different way their blood courses through the body, a different way of walking, a different way of blinking. You know, I mean, when they play this thing and have this type of background in improvisation, a phrase that Nicole Mitchell plays is not going to be the same phrase at all as another flute player plays, you know, although it's the same notes, you know?
Yeah.
And that's also part of the improvisatory situation, because oftentimes people think of improvisation as totally like, I'm just going to play free, but it's really these very subtle things that I'm very interested in. Where you take a breath, how you trail off a note at the end of a phrase. And because, again, I'm dealing with such master improvisers, I tell them ahead of time, you have complete freedom to interpret this how you want, as your own personal human, you know, expression. So that I find that interesting as well.
Yeah, I think every musician is idiosyncratic, and I think that's what you're getting at. There as well. You mentioned
but not all of them are aware of it. distinctly aware of it, I think is a whole nother level.
Yeah, I can see what you're saying there. I think some people might identify them by maybe their instrument. Jeff Parker might say, I'm a guitarist. Well, no, you're Jeff Parker. You happen to play guitar is maybe the better way of thinking about it. Is that maybe where you're coming from?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Don't mean to put words in your mouth, but I think that's a way of looking at it. Like, yeah.
No, that's part of it.
Yeah. Sure. You play guitar, or Nicole plays flute, in a way that only they can do it. I mean, as much as that's the joy of music for me, is like, I can't believe what I saw that person do with an instrument I've seen a million people play before. Like, that is a real marvel of appreciating craft, right? It's like someone is, I mean, that's why there's new music. If we were done, if we were like, no, no one's ever going to do it better than that. No. We're done. We don't have to make new records. Like, that would be hopeless. Yeah. But I think what you're getting at is like, every person brings something interesting to the, it's not, I'm not, you know, we got to be careful here. We don't want everyone to think they're special. You know, I have children, so we're constantly combating. Like, yeah, you're special, but don't think you're too special. Calm down. You're not like the greatest at everything. I have to say that to my son all the time. Anyway, you mentioned Nicole Mitchell. Can you talk? There's a community of musicians involved in Dimensional Stardust, and I wonder if you can talk both about some of them, who's people that you want to highlight, and I know that's going to be difficult because there's so many, but I'm also curious because I say community of musicians because, Rob, you circulate in a way that you end up playing with all sorts of people from different backgrounds, and when you put together your projects, I feel like you're a social convener. You're bringing people together who may not know each other, who may have never played together. So I wonder about that. Is this a totally familial or unfamiliar gathering? I mean, I also know from what I've read that some of this stuff was recorded remotely and sent to you and you figured it out. But can you speak to that? Right. Like how much of this is strangers coming together and how much of it is, all right, I got the old gang back together. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little of both because, you know, I have people like Jeff Parker and Damon Locks, who I've John Herndon, who I've played with for years and years. And Chad, of course, I started playing with Chad when he was 16 years old. It was in the 80s. Yeah. So it's like some of these people I have a really long relationship to. Others, none. Because like Joel Ross, for instance, the vibraphone player, love his sound, his approach and everything. Macy Stewart, who plays violin parts, I didn't know her at all. I think Scotty at the label recommended her. Then I heard some things she did with the group Ohm.
Yeah,
and I thought it was just amazing. So someone like Joel, who I don't know at all, but I can tell you feel the frequency of a person fairly immediately. If I don't feel that frequency from the person, that resonance from a person immediately, and I can't really put my finger on exactly what that is. But I had such a good feeling that Joel would play these vibraphone parts excellently and with his type of feel and sound, which is exactly what happened. Mm. Same thing with Macy Stewart. You know, I had never played with her either before, but bringing her into the session was an absolute treat. She also uses her voice a lot when she does things. I like people that use their voice and also play the instrument, just because I think you have a better understanding of the instrument when you also use your voice, you know?
I feel like this is going back. This is interesting because I feel like it's taking us back to what you were saying, like if about people being almost more important than their skill set or their instrument. Like you need to... Yeah. They need to resonate with you as a good hang, as good people, as much as like it's the drag to have the greatest drummer in the world be kind of a jerk or something, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's no fun.
Yes.
You know, you need a resonance that's going to pull out the things that you're trying to make happen in the music, you know? Yeah. So if I'm trying to make a music that's lifting and positive and whatever, I'm not going to hire a bass player that's a drag.
Yeah, exactly.
No matter how good they play, you know, because you need that energy, you know, which brings us to Ingebrigt. Ingebrigt Hackerflaten is one of the best bass players I've ever played with. Mm-hmm. I only started playing with him in I brought him out here for a Desert Encrypts thing, which is, it was a quartet with myself, Chris Davis on piano, Ingerbritt on bass, and Chad on drums. And he was just such a joy to be around and to play with, and such a wonderful player that he happened to be in Chicago at the same time that I was recording some of this stuff. So I was like, I got to get Ingerbritt in here with Chad because they have such a interesting hookup. You know? And Angelica Sanchez, who I've played with for a while, we did the Delmark record, you know, with the Pulsar Quartet. Yeah. And I don't know her a super long time, but her style and her aura and her energy is always so strong and elevating. I mean, what can you say about Tamika Reed? Same thing. Yeah. I mean, she has the ability to play one phrase and lift the whole group, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's a really interesting combination between, you know, musicians that I've played with for a long time, musicians that I've played with kind of, you know, a medium time, and completely new musicians with Macy and Joel.
Yeah, you know. And,
of course, Jamie Branch. So she has such a wonderful personality as well, and very, you know, fly or die.
Well, I mean, to listen to the record is really exhilarating because there is a certain collage-like aspect to it, for lack of a better term. Uh-huh. And I'm curious, like, given your experience making records, making music, this was a bit of an... Let me frame it this way. Was this more of an editing exercise in basically putting this record together? Was this more of an editing exercise for you than you might traditionally, complete? Or, like, I guess I'm comparing a live in the studio configuration off the floor versus this record, which is, as you use the term edited, so that makes me think, yeah, you had to do this. This is the result of some post-production and, you know, figuring out where things work. Is this an unusual amount of that kind of work in making this record for you?
I mean, kind of the editing had more to do with, like, where to place instruments.
Oh, okay.
So that thing. So the compositions were pretty much just the way they are. You know, I did some editing with extending a part or two. So there is some kind of Frankenstein movement. You know, not too much, but some.
Yeah.
But mostly with the editing of, like, where to, because I made it in such a way where I can move certain melodies over a beat or two, and it would have a similar effect. So I certainly experimented with that quite a bit, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, for the Exploding Star, this is the tenth suite I've made for the group. Mm-hmm. I think it's the sixth or seventh record. I don't know which one. The first record we did for Thrill Jockey, we are all from somewhere else. That's mostly composed as well, but with much more room for improvisation. Mm-hmm. The records after that kind of moved more and more into an open form type of situation where it was the compositional element was certainly there, but in lesser of a way. This record is very kind of super constructed.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay.
So between the editing of the instruments and certain parts and the way I did it, which I recorded, I think we never recorded more than two people at a time. So we had this incredible separation of beautiful sound, but everybody was right on the money. So it sounds magical in a sense. It's almost like turning a kaleidoscope.
Absolutely.
Every time you turn a kaleidoscope, it's like something beautiful and interesting happens. And all these parts were played in such a beautiful, personal, but rigorous way that I had a lot of options as far as editing and reconstructing. But there wasn't a lot of that. It was mostly just about getting certain things and certain instruments to be right in the right spot that I wanted them.
Well, it's definitely a
I
very
hope that was,
no, that's you know. That helps. Don't sell yourself short. That was a great answer. What do you? It was good. I just wanted to say, like, it is a very vivid and colorful record, if that makes sense. Like that.
Yeah.
that no, lushness, totally. Yeah, that comes through. That it's got a visceral sort of feeling to it too. Like I guess what I want to ask in the end is, was there anything about putting this record together, anything about the performances or anything else really that surprises you or surprised you at the time? And within that, is there anything about the reception to it that has surprised you? Because you've just been doing this a long time and you're constantly exploring. And when you're constantly exploring and looking for something, I think it can be sometimes harder and harder to get surprised because you're setting yourself up to constantly be thrilled by discovery and whatnot. Was there anything in particular about this record, and like I say, the life it's leading now, that has particularly surprised you?
Well, I can say one thing about that. I mean, when I got my vinyl a couple of days ago, I was I was giddy as a little schoolgirl, you know, boy, they, everything. I was like, you know, this, I put it on, you know, from the Sun Quartet to the Autumn Pleiades, I was like, and because of that, I thought something special is on this record, because after hundreds of times of listening to this thing over and over again and working on it, I still find it it makes my heart sing. Okay,
yeah.
But a kind of a special thing that happened, and which I'm very happy. I think the world is happy. The Careening Prism Within, Parable 43.
Yeah,
we made this record when we were doing the final edit on the thing some 6, 7, 8 months ago, maybe 8 months ago. With the final edit, there's a point in The Careening Prism Within where Damon Locks says the words, "Disaster is coming." And it's right before Jeff Parker's searing second soloistic thing he does on that song. Hmm. Right before that break, Damon said, and the thing, "Disaster is coming." Now, because I wanted this record to lift and have a kind of, I said, "Damon, do you mind if I take that one phrase and reverse the phrase on the record, thus reversing disaster that we hope is not coming."
Hmm.
And he was totally cool with that. So we reversed the "disaster is coming" on Careening Prism, and thank the heavens that the monster that is in office now will be leaving the office.
Ah.
And I look at that as a contribution to sending energy out there to make this world a better place through that particular act. So for those of you interested, listen to The Greening Prison Within right before Jeff Parker's second searing solo. If you reverse it on your turntable, you will hear something interesting.
Well, I will say thank you for making that decision. I think it worked. And secondly,
thank
you for that insight. I will listen for that the next time I listen to the song. I didn't catch that. That's very interesting. So, Rob, if people want to learn more about Dimensional Stardust or you or anything else, where would you like to send them, first of all?
Well, I mean, the record's available through International Anthem Records, which International Anthem Bandcamp, I guess, is the best place. Also, it's a dual release with Nonesuch Records, so nonesuch.com. And, I mean, I have my personal website that has all the information on it as well, which is robmazurek.com.
Okay. Now, this has become a tricky question given the various states of suspension that we are all living through. But do you have any future plans or anything else coming up beyond this record that you want to share?
There's a trio record that is coming out. I think the first single is coming out in December. And the full record, I think, is coming out in January with Mats Gustafsson, the great saxophonist from Sweden.
Yeah.
Is it Sweden?
I believe so, yes. Yeah. Yes.
but he's living in Austria now.
Oh, okay.
We made a record 2 years ago that with also David Grubbs, an amazing guitar player.
Nice.
That will be coming out on Blue Chopsticks Records as part of a Drag City release.
Okay.
And I just finished this. There's a bunch of different releases coming out. So it's, you know, there's a solo piccolo trumpet release that's going to come out on Rogue Art jazz label, which I recorded in the 100 aluminum Judd aluminum box space, which is an amazing space. I've been working on this really interesting project with these architects, AWP in Paris, working on an urban architectural project where they asked me to create sound that was collected from the site, turning that into sound and music, that music turning my paintings into architecture from the special video program I've been using to do that, extracting the architectural design for that and then using that in a new book. So that's very interesting. And
wow, okay, lots going on then. You're not suspended, we're all suspended. Yeah. You're just making all sorts
maybe
of stuff.
It's too much.
I want to
do more.
Everything you make,
everything
you make is a hopeful gesture, if I might say. It's hopeful. The more you can make, the better I think we'll all feel, because the more hopefully we all start to make stuff ourselves, because we need little glimmers of hope. Everything you make, I think, is a little glimmer of hope. So thank you. I just want to say that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. We're all makers.
I agree. So robmazurek.com to keep up with all of the various things that Rob just said, I guess, is the easiest thing to say. If we can go out on a song from Dimensional Stardust, Rob, I mean, you just talked about one to a great extent. Will we be teases if we don't play that particular song? I don't want to put any ideas in your head. Do you want to pick a song for us to go out on right now?
I mean, the Creating Prism Within is pretty intense and beautiful.
Yeah, I think we should play it. This is the Creating Prism Within. By the way, what's with all the parables? You've got this one says Parable 43. What certain songs have a parable designation? Why? What does that mean to you, Rob?
I came up with a character, an imaginary writer, alchemist, filmmaker, composer from Brasilia, Brazil, by the name of Elder Velasquez Smith. And this character has been in my mind for the last 15 years.
Ah.
And every now and then he comes out with parables and little stories about certain things, mostly about how we're going to build androids in the future and how we can have the androids feel the same thing that humans feel.
Oh, okay. Interesting. All right. So we are meant to listen to this with the notion that this character is conveying something to us in some to some degree.
Yes.
Okay. All right. This is the Careening Prism Within, Parable 43, from the excellent new album Dimensional Stardust. This is by Rob Mazurek's Exploding Star Orchestra. Rob, thank you so much for being back on the show. I all my best to you and your loved ones, and all the best in the future.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ah, very nice to have Rob Mazurek back on this show. In this case, for the 585th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever it is you get your podcasts, all of the platforms that you can think of, Apple, Google, Spotify, everything. If you can't find an episode that you've heard about, you're looking for it, and you can't find it, no matter where you look, you're looking under rocks, you're looking in your computer, you're looking in your old computer, where is this? Or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my regularly scheduled newsletter, it's a monthly newsletter, is the new plan. Anyway, for all of those things, you can learn about how to do or, you know, engage with all of that stuff at my website, vishkana.com. You can like Creative Control on social media platforms like Facebook or follow us on Twitter at vishcreative. You can also follow me on Instagram and on Twitter at vishkana. Also, visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to keep this podcast going. $6 or more grants you access to exclusive audio content, maybe even exclusive video content if I can get my stuff together there. But trying to reward people the best I can. So whatever you can donate, don't feel if you can't afford $6 a month, that's totally fine. You can do whatever you want, any amount, literally any amount, and you can always change it. Your support definitely helps. So please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol. Thanks again to liveatmasseyhall.com, where you can watch beautifully captured concerts by some great Canadian artists. Also want to thank Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. Speaking of kind, sort of, Jim Guthrie loans me music that he made that I can use for this show, and he's the best. You can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode with Rob Mazurek, my old friend from our Guelph Jazz Festival encounters. I miss the Guelph Jazz Festival. I miss seeing Rob play live. It seems almost at least every couple of years he would be up in Guelph, and I miss it all very much, but it was nice to connect this way. And thank you for listening to this episode. I hope you'll check out other episodes and follow or subscribe to this podcast so you can stay on top of it. And if you like it, tell your friends that maybe they should check it out. That always helps. I like that. I like hearing those stories from people. And that's it. I'll be back with you before you know it with another episode. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you soon. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.